This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a Black radical candidate explains how you can run a winning political campaign even if you lose the election. And first, they stole the people's right to vote in Detroit. Then they stole the water. And then everything else.
But first, two researchers at the Institute for Policy Studies have released a new examination on wealth concentration and inequality in the United States. Chuck Collins and Josh Hoxie's report is titled Billionaire Bonanza 2017. We spoke to Collins at his office in Washington. He says three billionaires, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, own more wealth than the entire bottom half of the U.S. population, 160 million people.
The power of this to me is to signal, you know, we've crossed a number of lines. The United States has had an extraordinary inequality, but we're sort of in this hyper inequality phase. And it's hard to make the case that this has anything to do with individual effort or deservedness. We were just looking at Jeff Bezos and how his wealth increased by $10 billion as Amazon stock rose. And we figured that he was making about $4 million in wealth every minute. So we're really kind of moving into a hyper inequality phase, an advanced sort of plutocracy wealth creating wealth dynamic.
Yes, the question when you have a coterie of people of this kind of fabulous wealth isn't so much how do they exercise inordinate power in society, but how could they not be a kind of dictatorship of wealth?
Yeah, it really is like water running down a hill when it comes to money and influence. That money just wants to influence. It wants to shape the culture. It wants to shape the politics. It wants to dictate what's right and what's wrong. You know, as Louis Brandeis said, you know, you can have concentrated wealth in the hands of a few, or you can have something that resembles a democracy, but you really can't have both. And he said that during the first Gilded Age, the 100 years ago, when they also had these kind of dizzying, dazzling inequalities.
Well, you say these kinds of dizzying, dazzling inequalities, but how does it statistically compare to this previous golden age?
Well, I think that it's pretty comparable. We don't actually have the exact measures. We don't, you know, for instance, just how much wealth the share of the economy the super rich had 100 years ago. But we do know that there were these huge kind of monopoly interests. They really did command and control the political system. Not to say that in the period in between that there was full democracy by any means, but the rich didn't always get their way in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s. So it was considered a kind of a plutocratic moment. And it gave rise to social movements, you know, the emergence of the labor movement, the emergence of women's and civil rights movements really were a result of that concentration of wealth. And how it not only captured our democracy, but it led to a depression. And I think that's one thing that people don't really pay attention to. When you have this level of concentrated wealth, it tends to fuel speculative binges and busts and booms, and it destabilizes the economy because rich people are essentially, you know, looking for the highest financial returns for their investments. They've delinked from the real economy of goods and services and consumption. They're just looking to have their money multiply, and that leads them into the most high-risk speculative elements of the economy. And then, lo and behold, there's kind of a crash. So that happened the last time around, and I think we can say that it just really jeopardizes that sort of basic stability of economic activity.
Yes, one could almost say that the crisis of capitalism is that the capitalists have won so fabulously.
I think so, you know, and I think that we're living in this hyper-extractive capitalism phase. And actually, one of the things I think that happens, you know, if you and I had talked about inequality a decade ago, I would have said, geez, you know, people are really not paying attention to these dynamics. But I think something's happened. I think that the tolerance for high levels of inequality is lowering. People see that there's a connection, that they do feel the economy is rigged. They feel that the rules of the economy are working against them. They feel nickel and dimed by every corporation that they have a relationship with, whether it's your cell phone carrier or your internet provider, or that wealth is being pulled out of our wallets and our bank accounts and funneled upwards. So I think there's a shared experience that these inequalities really matter, really undermine the quality of life for everybody.
And it's not just simply that people like Bezos can add $10 billion to their accounts in a very short period of time, but that most people, their standard of living over the past couple of decades has been flat, or in the case of some groups, actually gone backwards.
Yeah, and I think that we really, in this report, Billionaire Bonanza, say, you know, part of what's the dynamic here is clearly the pooling of wealth at the top. But the ranks of underwater nation continue to rise. So one out of five households has zero or negative wealth. The reason we can say three billionaires, Bezos, Gates, and Buffett, have as much wealth as the bottom half of all U.S. households is because the first 20% of households don't have any wealth or have negative net worth. And then the next segment have very small amounts of money. In 1983, the household in the middle had $83,000 in net worth. It's easy to remember that number because it was 1983 and $83,000 in median wealth in today's dollars. And today, based on this most recent Fed survey, they have $80,000. So even right in the middle, households have just slipped ground. And you can see the housing ownership rate is going down. There are trends like that that are clearly unhealthy. And then if you put, you know, a racial lens on it, 30% of black households, zero or negative net worth, 27% of Latino households, zero or negative net worth. So those who are on the edge, who have little or nothing to fall back on, is a huge segment of the population. And for people of color, it's twice the precariousness. So this isn't news to you, but it is, I think, a really important to look at those trends side by side.
And we see people like Bezos, by the nature of his business, contributes institutionally to the precariousness of others.
Yeah, you know, it's no coincidence that maybe in the 2 months since his stock went up almost $20 billion, that communities around the country are auctioning off the opportunity to host, you know, Amazon's second headquarters, and they're putting all kinds of public treasury resources on the line. There's sort of a race to the bottom. Who will give away as much of their local stores and treasures to attract Amazon? So that little bidding war, I think, was part of what added to Amazon's value or wealth, their ability to command and dictate such things as which community will they relocate in. They're a powerful force, a powerful economic force. And then what they are able to do to for consumers and for manufacturers. You know, if you're trying to sell a product, you're in a race against Amazon as they destroy one main street after another.
And not only does Jeff Bezos money talk, but he owns the second most influential newspaper in the country. And Bill Gates, through his enterprises and foundations, seems to be a controlling actor in U.S. health policy overseas.
You know, you make an important point, Glenn, which is that sometimes people feel like people's philanthropy is different than their economic activity. But one of the danger signs here is the concentration of power, even in charities and philanthropies. These charities become an extension of the interests of these individual billionaires. So I think the trend we see today is going to become only more so
as many of these billionaires set up charitable foundations. You know, some of them do, I think, you know, fund decent things, but it doesn't matter, because it's what's important to understand is this is just another extension of private power that's unaccountable and that you and I subsidize. You know, for every dollar that a billionaire gives to his or her charitable foundation, you and I taxpayers are chipping in 40 to 50 cents in lost tax revenue. So we actually have a public interest. We publicly subsidize these individuals' private charity agendas. And then you have a Gates Foundation that can put its thumb on the scale on education policy, on global agricultural policy, healthcare policy. Sometimes they maybe do the right thing, but it's just wrong that some one interest or family should have so much power.
And not only do these billionaires have vast powers as a class, but there are so many of them that they can pick and choose candidates. We saw in 2016 and previously whole flocks of candidates, each of which seemed to have one or two billionaires propelling them.
You know, I think one of the reasons that the Republican field was able to keep these, whatever, they had 10 or 11 candidates at one point that just kept going like the Energizer Bunny. They didn't have to drop out. And why was that? It's because you only needed one real billionaire patron to keep your election going, your campaign going. And if that billionaire said, well, I want you to continue to stay in the race so that you can represent my perspective on taxes or on how the economy should work, they essentially, you know, kept those candidacies alive. You know, in the past, if a candidate wasn't popular with the voters, at some point they had to drop out. Now all you have to be is popular with the billionaire.
Clearly it takes political action to control that kind of capital power, but these billionaires control both of the corporate political parties.
I would say one thing that I find somewhat heartening is people are not necessarily falling for that. I mean, here we have this tax plan that is really being pushed through by the powerful corporations and the wealthy. And, you know, 28% of voters actually think it's a good idea. Most people aren't falling for it. They actually understand that it's a money grab and that they're not going to personally benefit, and that maybe a few morsels will be tossed to ordinary taxpayers, but that's just a political strategy to confuse us. But I think people are basically not falling for it. I think that we're witnessing a realignment. You wouldn't know about it reading about it in the corporate media, but I think there's a realignment in both political parties. I think there's a realignment at the base and under outside of parties of people who are saying, you know, these inequalities, this concentration of wealth, the fact that our economy is dominated by a couple hundred billionaires is fundamentally threatening everything that people care about. And I think it is lending itself to a waking up. It may not be as fast as we hope it could be, but it's definitely, I find, having an impact. And that's why we do these reports. I think that there's somewhat of a shock value, but it also just reinforces a story people understand that this can't be good. It can't be good to have so much power in so few hands.
Russia has its share of billionaires, and Americans don't hesitate to call them oligarchs and use that term in a pejorative sense, but they don't seem to like to call their own billionaires, who are richer than the Russian ones, oligarchs.
The word oligarchy is something that we have a hard time wrapping our mouths around, but if you understand what an oligarchy is, a society essentially governed by its wealthy, or a plutocracy, a society governed by a small elite. Even President Carter recently said, you know, look, we're living in an oligarchy, a political system governed by the wealthy. And I think, the more we kind of come to grips with that, the more less deluded we'll be about some of the sort of little differences and squabbles between Democrats and Republicans when we understand that the whole system has oligarchic characteristics and that we're being distracted by some of the party politics games.
And I know, of course, that you say there are stirrings in the land, but where is the party of the anti-oligarchs?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's in communities, it's in the streets, it's in outside the party formations. I think the Black Lives Matter movement, I think the our revolution or some of the efforts at in local levels too. Sometimes it's working inside the Democratic Party, but having a caucus outside of that party. And, you know, I think we saw a number of candidates win seats in state legislatures and in city councils a couple days ago that are a reflection of that undercurrent. So there's no outside formation that's clearly unified everyone yet, but you can start to see the seeds of that.
That was Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington.
The Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations marched on the White House and held its national conference at Howard University in Washington. The theme of the conference was The Ballot and the Bullet, Elections, War, and Peace in the Era of Donald Trump. Among those who spoke at the conference was Eritha Akile Kanyon, a 20-year-old member of the African People's Socialist Party, who ran for city council in St. Petersburg, Florida.
I'm a member of the African People's Socialist Party. We're a revolutionary organization, and we understand that the electoral arena is not going to free African people. A vote is not going to free African people. But we understand that the struggle has to take on every front, including the electoral front. And that's exactly what it was that we did in St. Petersburg, Florida. The campaigns that we ran on adopted the 19-point platform of the National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination. St. Petersburg is a majority white city. You know, it's only 23% African. And we ran on the slogan, unity through reparations. And we ran on the slogan, you know, not as, obviously African people are clear, reparations are owed to African people, everything has been stolen from African people, but in a majority white city, people thought we were crazy for running on the platform, unity through reparations. How do we think we're going to get votes based on that platform? And we said it was a call to white people. It was a call to the majority white city to stand on the side of the African working class community with reparations to African people, because we understood that reparations to African people could solve every contradiction that the city of St. Pete and even, the rest of this world faces. It starts with reparations to African people. We made that explicitly clear. Also, I ran for District 6 City Council and Jesse Neville ran for mayor. And the reason it wasn't vice versa was because we were in a majority white city, and it was a strategy to win a majority white city through Jesse Neville to the, you know, under the leadership of the African working class. It was very clear that I ran for District 6, and the African working class was the clear leadership of the entire campaign, including Jesse Neville. Jesse Neville made it very clear, we are under the leadership of the African working class, and Jesse's responsibility was to win a majority white city to the agenda of the African working class. And of course, we went against this entire machine. We've talked about how it's a machine. We talked about how the elections are nothing but a nonviolent contest between sections of the ruling class. And, you know, the local elections in St. Peter are supposed to be a nonpartisan election, but it was extremely partisan. And we had to go not only up against the big money, the gentrifiers, and everything that they had in their arsenal, but we had to go against tradition. The voting for Democrat and voting for Republican, we had to go against all of that. We had to go against the entire status quo. And just to talk about even what our platform consisted of, I mean, we were talking about black community control of police, black community control of schools. We talked about ending gentrification and, you know, creating affordable housing for African people, because just like every place in this country, African people are being forced out of our own communities. And it's no different from St. Petersburg, Florida. In fact, I lived there all my life, but how it looked 10 years ago is not how it looks now, in the fact that, you know, community, the African community barely exists there. And so we said to end gentrification, because also it's a seriously violent process to push African people out of your community. It requires extreme violence. And of course, reparations and economic development for African people was, you know, the cornerstone of this agenda. We also talked about the ending of gentrification, the end to gerrymandering, you know, because we ran for District 6, and in context of, you know, how St. Pete is set up, it's 8 districts in the city, and the district that we ran in had been gerrymandered, so that means they basically cut out parts of the district and replaced it with new ones. And District 6 used to be one of the only majority African districts in the city, and since the gerrymandering of the district, now it's majority white, and it includes the wealthiest part of St. Pete and the most impoverished part of St. Pete. So District 6 was a serious battleground because in this district, it has like downtown St. Pete, all this prime real estate, all the areas where the big money gentrifiers want to be. And it was a contest really for the African community to be able to, it was basically a fight for our lives, you know, to be able to stay in our own communities. And so we called for a genuine single member district election, which requires that, because how it's split up now, in a nonpartisan race in St. Petersburg, Florida, you have a primary and you have a general election. That's only seen in the presidential election. That's not seen on any local level. And what it does is it vetoes any ability for African people, you know, for any vote. In fact, in District 6, had every African registered voter voted for even an African candidate, we still couldn't have won against the white community in that particular district. Let alone being opened up to a general election and then having the majority of the city, which is majority white, vote on who gets to represent the African community. So we called for a genuine single-member district election, eliminate a primary, and only the people of that district get to vote on who represents them. And we even dealt with, you know, all these issues like restoration of voters' rights, because we know that all those things attack, you know, the African working class, because they, one, they force you to extreme states of poverty, and then they stick the police into your community and arrest you for all these petty crimes and then slap this label of felon on you, and now you have no, you know, no ability to vote. So not only are we dealing with a low population of African people in St. Pete, we have a limited amount of African voters because the majority of the African working class has been labeled as felons. In fact, we ran into that a lot. We were going into the community, knocking on every door, and African men were coming and saying, they can't vote, but my wife can. So that was the reality that we were confronted with. And again, we ran against this big money, you know, these crooks, these gentrifiers, the whole status quo, including their media apparatus, because the local media there slandered, you know, the Uhuru movement because it was clear that we were, you know, candidates of the Uhuru movement. In fact, they tried to label us that as some negative thing, but we, you know, wore that like, yeah, look at all the Uhuru movement has done, and look at the intense struggle that the Uhuru movement and Chairman Mali Jachela has been engaged in, you know, for 50 plus years. Yes, we are the Uhuru candidate. And they tried everything they could to slander this campaign, and they used all the media that they had to do it because it was obvious the media worked for the big money interests. And also, this has been the most expensive mayoral race in history. And big, both the big money candidates are Rick Krasner and Rick Baker, big money millionaires who, you know, raised over, within the first, you know, 5 months, raised over $1 million alone for their own campaigns. Over $1 million, the most expensive mayoral race in a St. Pete local election. And again, a part of attacking this movement with everything they had in their arsenal, because it was extremely powerful. I mean, it was affecting not just St. Petersburg, but eyes were watching all over this country and around the world, really rooting for unity through reparations, rooting for this movement that we had growing in St. Pete, because it was a model for what's possible in every other place. What we accomplished in St. Pete is possible everywhere. So they had, you know, this one televised debate, and it was the only televised debate of the whole election, and they only invited the two mayoral, the big money mayoral candidates who had raised so-called over $25,000. That's why they said they did it. But this has never been the case in any mayoral election. All mayoral candidates have been invited prior to Jesse Neville entering the mayoral election, and prior to Chairman Amalia Chitella entering the mayoral election, prior to Unity Through Reparations being a campaign slogan in a local election, they let every other mayoral candidate into that televised debate, but not this time around. They made sure that the masses of people could not hear the platform Unity Through Reparations, and they kept Jesse Neville out, and they also kept the people out. They closed the audience to only supporters of the big money candidates. And so again, this was a part of everything they did to squash our movement. They even had big money candidates deploying forces into, you know, the African community, snatching up our yard signs and holding secret debates. I mean, that was just like, you know, the ruling class like up in arms because this campaign was hitting them from every angle. And then it only gets better from there because now we're talking about shattering the decorum. And, you know, what you typically see in bourgeois elections are basically ruling class candidates having a conversation amongst themselves about how they're going to police the African community more, and how they're, you know, who's going to be the better oppressor, who's going to have the bigger boot on the necks of African people. That's not the discussion they got to have this time around in this local election, because we brought this platform, that's, it was a program, it was an agenda that spoke to the direct interests of the African working class. So there's a famous story, it's called the Hilton story, and it's where everything was set off, where the African community came into the Hilton Hotel at a forum for District 6 and mayoral candidates, hosted by the League of White Women Voters. And they had set up all these rules and regulations to make sure that the voice of the African working class could not be heard. And one, you had to be there. First of all, I mean, even organizing and getting everybody into the room. And then you have Chair Namalia Shatella, and then you have a flood of people coming in behind him to come into the room. It was such a magnificent experience. And then, so we're on this platform, and, you know, we're talking about, you know, Black women patrol the police. We're talking about the murders of three Black teenage girls, Dominique Battle, Nanaimo, and Ashanti Butler, conversations you wouldn't usually get to have in a debate. And, you know, the people are electrified. They are so enthusiastic. This is something they've never seen before, but they are so galvanized because, you know, this is finally what the people have been wanting to hear. And, you know, the ruling class, the bourgeoisie, couldn't contain that. Could not contain it. They did everything they could. And as a result, I don't know if there was fisticuffs. There probably was. But, I mean, that whole debate went up, and it was amazing. It's beautiful. And they called, you know, they called 23 police. By the time we came out of the building, there were 23 police cars outside waiting for us. They had to call the pigs on us because the people were so enthusiastic about using the police. And every debate after that, they had to prepare themselves. And they were, like, pleading with us, like, please, y'all, just please applaud at the end or something. Like, but that was how every debate went. There was nothing boring about it. In fact, people who never voted before, people who, you know, have never come to a debate before, came because we were there, because the platform of Unity Reparations was there. That's why people were so invested in the subject because we were there. And we were such a threat to the status quo that even people like, you know, the local chair of the Democratic Party and even the spokesperson of the St. Petersburg Police Department came out and called this movement, the Huru movement, and our campaigns domestic terrorists. And, well, you know, I mean, obviously, when the U.S. government labels somebody as a terrorist, you know, they have basically a plan. Basically, we've already seen what happens when they call African people a terrorist, when we're fighting for the right to be self-determined. We're fighting, you know, for the right to have power in our own hands, to be economically self-reliant, and that's some terrorist attack, you know, on the status quo. But it is. So, you know, we were categorized as domestic terrorists, and that's how shook the status quo was. And again, we were in the process of building a people's movement because big money had everything they could buy. They had whatever they wanted, they could afford it. We didn't have those resources. We had the African working class, we had the people of the city, and we were involved in building a people's movement for reparations and economic development to African people. And in fact, part of that strategy to begin with, to even get Jesse Neville qualified on the ballot, we went and got over 2,000 signatures, you know, because you can either pay a fee or get signatures. And you had to get 2,000, and we had to keep going out because they kept throwing out signatures, but the people were determined to get Jesse Neville on the ballot, so we managed to get Jesse Neville on the ballot, not with money, but with the people. And, I mean, but there were so many things involved in building this campaign because we didn't have resources, so we had to have door-to-door, you know, and Charles Barron, you know, the New York State Assemblyman, who also endorsed our campaign, you know, he said door-to-door wins the war, and that we knocked on over 20,000 doors, you know, talking to the people up early in the morning to late at night in the sweltering heat, knocking on doors, getting yes votes, getting these yard signs out, also phone banking. We had an incredible phone banking team, and, you know, people from all over this country were involved in phone banking, you know, all the registered voters in the city to let them know about our campaigns. We had an amazing social media team that was headed up by Gazi Koto, and, you know, just an amazing social media apparatus, constantly putting out videos, statements, and all these different kinds of things. We became pros at hosting press conferences in, like, under 24 hours. And also, you know, we said that the people were so energized about this campaign, but we really saw the masses of African youth. I mean, there were so many African teenagers from high school, you know, can't vote, but they were out here because this is where the future is. And they saw, you know, they saw their future in this campaign, and they fought like hell to make it happen. Also, I can't, you know, overlook the petty bourgeoisie, the slime of the petty bourgeoisie, you know, and, I mean, they just committed so many horrendous attacks, just in terms of even speaking on the African working class. alone, and they were all in it for, you know, the interest of the ruling class. You know, even had like the churches, the African churches, collaborating with the ruling class. And speaking on the tax on the African working class, one of the critical, you know, topics of these campaigns was the question of African children and the African community, and in particular, this case around the three drowned black girls where the Pinellas County Sheriff's Department murdered three African teenage girls, Dominique, Lanaya, and Ashanti. And they attacked these three girls, they attacked the mother of Dominique Battle, Kunle Mwambita, time and time and time again. And this year, on August 7th, they murdered three African teenage boys. The Pinellas County Sheriff's Department did. They chased them and led them into a fiery crash. And again, it's the same thing that they did with the teenage girls. They went on a slander campaign like less than 24 hours after, you know, these Africans have been murdered. They went about plastering their mugshots everywhere and saying it's a car theft epidemic. And that the African working class, you know, has a car theft problem. And that's an excuse to put more task force, an excuse to put more police into the African community. So we experienced all these different attacks, and the car theft epidemic was no different from any of the other attacks on the African working class. And so by the end of this campaign, we had a television ad, we knocked on over 20,000 doors, phone banked to over 10,000 people, featured in Ebony Magazine, BBC, Press TV, even The Breakfast Club, because there was this white nationalist named Paul Kajemi, who, you know, made these crazy statements during the mayoral debate in response to Jesse Neville and the Platform Unity for Reparations. We also led a march of over 200 people in gentrified St. Pete. So going right through the white community, you have all these people, including a rather large presence of white people in this march, chanting unity through reparations through gentrified St. Pete. And also, as a result of these elections, we established this new organization called Communities United for Reparations and Economic Development that deals with taking the agenda of the African working class into the electoral arena. And on top of all of these attacks against our campaigns, they even brought in neo-colonial puppet Barack Hussein Obama into St. Petersburg's local election. And it was just so pathetic because, I mean, they kept using like the Trump card and the Obama card against each other. And then for the second time in Obama's history, he endorsed a mayoral candidate, not because he was in opposition to the ruling class Republican candidate, but it was because of this movement and because it was in direct opposition to reparations and African people. So, you know, we got the attention and the alarm of Barack Obama, you know, into the local election, which is no small feat. And again, so reparations was the cornerstone of our agenda. And again, it's because it was clear that that solves all the problems that existed in this city and everywhere it is that African people are around the world. And one of our prime examples of that was this thing called the Tropicana Field. And Tropicana Field is a baseball stadium for this mediocre baseball team. And in the 90s, they crushed what was then one of the most historic African communities called the Gas Plant District. And, you know, that community had over 100 black-owned businesses, you know, 800 families, homes. It was a whole community there. And they crushed that community, and they built the dome on top of that community. They even paved over a graveyard. We're hearing this very, you know, this reoccurring theme. Paved over a graveyard where African people were buried to build a parking lot for the dome. And in this election, you know, because the Rays, that's the name of the team, they don't know, you know, where they're going to go, they're up, their contract's up or whatever. And so they don't know what they're going to do with this land. And we made it explicitly clear that, one, it's not your decision, and two, that land is going back to the African community to build affordable housing and economic development. And as a result, on top of saying that, you know, reparations solves all the problems, we're saying that creating affordable housing and economic development on that land, if you create affordable housing, it relieves the, you know, the pressure off the housing market and it lowers the cost of rent for everybody in the city. And we're saying building economic development, jobs, businesses for the African community, it increases the tax-based revenue, you know, for the city. So all these issues directly encircle the oppression of the African community, and we can end all these contradictions. And you know that white people don't have to be complicit and live at the expense of African people, but there can be unity, but only through reparations to African people. So, you know, that was just, the cornerstone of our agenda. And it was taking, you know, what the Black is Back, you know, coalition, and what we're even saying right now with this conference about the ballot and the bullet, elections, war, and peace in the era of Donald Trump. And this is the kind of work that we have to be engaged in, and that's why we're building Communities United for Reparations and Economic Development, because we entered this election with the objective to win. And we didn't win the bourgeois election. but we build cured. It was a very amazing campaign with the strategy built by Chairman Mazzucchelli and the adoption of the National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination. So, and we will be running for office in the near future in St. Petersburg, Florida, and wanting to carry out this work every day.
Also speaking at the Black is Back Coalition Conference was Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, the veteran activist with the No Fear Coalition and an editor of Black Agenda Report. Adebayo asked the coalition for solidarity and assistance.
We're engaged in a struggle very similar to the New York African Burial Ground Project, and we need your help. The very core of this struggle centers around African ownership of land, the dignity of African people, both alive and dead, and reparations. Bethesda, Maryland has become the site of the latest battleground to challenge the right of corporations and city governments to defile and desecrate ancestral African land and to disregard the rights of African people. 3 years after Emancipation Proclamation, around 1868, Africans in Bethesda pooled their money together and purchased land from former terrorists called European slave masters or plantation owners. This community built the main artery of Bethesda called River Road and the most prestigious avenue in the city called Bradley Road. In fact, during World War II, the White House sent trucks to this African community to pick up workers from River Road to build the bunkers under the White House. Because it was illegal for black folks and white folks to be buried in the same space, the African community, a benevolent organization in 1911, called the White's Tabernacle No. 39 of the Ancient United Order of the Brothers and Sisters, Sons and Daughters of Moses, bought Moses Cemetery. The River Road African colony raised families, established businesses, served in the military, built schools and churches for nearly 100 years. By 1959, the business community realized how valuable the land owned by Africans were in Bethesda and decided to confiscate or steal the land. The confiscation took place through illegal tax schemes, intimidation and harassment. African families were forced to flee and move in with nearby relatives. After Brown v. Board in 1954, the black school described as supportive and loving was torn down, and black students were forced to attend all white schools that they described as battlefields. After Africans were displaced on River Road, corporations in conjunction the county government decided to desecrate the Moses Cemetery. Grave markers were crushed, and the cemetery was paved over to make a parking lot for a nearby housing project. Now the county and Regency Centers, a $14 billion corporation, plan to build a garage on top of the already desecrated parking lot that housed our ancestors. The River Road African community, its history, its contribution was supposed to simply vanish. The people under the parking lot considered trash and their contributions irrelevant. In fact, this community buried in Moses Cemetery was the first generation of freed Africans in Montgomery County. These were the people that Harriet Tubman risked her life to free from American terrorism. The only remaining African institution on River Road is the Macedonia Baptist Church. For the past year, we've waged the people's struggle to take back the land stolen by Montgomery County and local white businesses. We developed community outreach protests called Justice Tuesdays, in which our goal was to shut down the county council and its planning boards. In fact, we have successfully shut down the county council over 5 times now, and we've shut down HOC 3 times. We've also been able to force a moratorium on Regency's plan to build the garage, so they're literally losing nearly $2 million a day because of our protests. We've been able to raise the issue of reparations from the perspective of individual former landowners. One member of our group, Harvey Matthews, has family roots back to the African colony on River Road. His family's land was recently bought by Amazon Whole Foods for $60 million. We are now demanding that Amazon provide $60 million in reparations to the Matthews family. Julius Malema, the leader of the South African Economic Freedom Fighters and a member of parliament, has said of the land question, "We all know that the Dutch gangsters arrived here and took our land by force. The struggle has since been about the return of the land into the hands of rightful owners. South Africa remains a conquered nation because white monopoly capital still owns the means of production, and at the center of that was the land question. Without land, Malema said, we are nothing. At the center of our struggle is the struggle for land and reparations."
That was Marsha Coleman Adebayo at the Black is Back Coalition National Conference in Washington.
The citizens of the Black metropolis of Detroit were stripped of their right to manage their local affairs by a bankruptcy process imposed on the city in 2013. Since then, hundreds of thousands of Detroit households have faced cutoffs of water. Dr. Josiah Rector, a professor of history at Northland College, spoke recently at Detroit's Museum of African American History. Dr. Rector said the same bankers and financiers that bankrupted Detroit have stolen the people's right to water.
Detroit had the highest rate of subprime mortgage foreclosures in the entire United States between 2005 and 2007. This was ground zero for the marketing of these dangerous instruments by the same banks that would be bailed out in 2008, first in the TARP 1 and then the TARP 2 program to the tune of literally trillions of dollars. So as a result of this, Detroit, literally one in three, a third of the properties in the city of Detroit go into foreclosure between 2005 and 2015 through a combination of subprime foreclosures, tax foreclosures, and other things. At the same time, of course, when Wall Street is bailed out for engaging in this behavior, the executives award themselves even higher bonuses than before in 2009, even after they had been bailed out, and they never get prosecuted. But this is tightly intertwined with the water crisis, because many homeowners, as they're facing these runaway payments on these adjustable rate mortgages, with the rates being adjusted further and further up, are not able to pay those payments, and so they stop paying their water bills, or they're unable to do so. Other cases, people's water bills are added to their tax liens, which leads to more tax foreclosures. I think 7,000 tax foreclosures are attributable to water bills in Detroit just over the last few years. And so this predatory behavior is directly related to the explosion of water shutoffs. Now, the final ingredient in this mess is emergency financial management. Now, what happens, of course, in 2011 is that Governor Rick Snyder expands the power of emergency financial managers to Public Act 4. This allows suspension of collective bargaining for up to 5 years. It enables emergency financial managers to completely scrap collective bargaining agreements, to dissolve school boards, even to dissolve entire municipalities. And under that, Robert Bob lays off all Detroit school teachers, for instance. But what happens, of course, is the Stand Up for Democracy campaign gets a referendum on the ballot in fall 2012, and a majority of Michigan voters, 52%, including 82% of Detroit voters, choose to overturn or reject Public Act 4. And so then, during the lame duck session in December, Rick Snyder passes a copycat bill while also signing a right-to-work bill, which basically recreates the emergency manager law but embeds it in a budget appropriation bill so that it can't be overturned by popular referendum. Under that copycat bill, called Public Act 436, Snyder appoints Kevin Orr as the emergency manager of Detroit in March 2013. And I'm sure most of you know this history, so I won't run through it in too much detail, but how does it relate to water? So, of course, we all know that Kevin Orr files bankruptcy for the city of Detroit. But what he also does is Kevin Orr leases Belle Isle to the state of Michigan for 30 years. He privatizes the Detroit Lighting Department, renaming it the Detroit Lighting Authority. He privatized waste collection to Rizzo Services, rather than the Department of Public Works. And, of course, he opened negotiations with the suburbs about regionalizing the Detroit water system under a Great Lakes Water Authority. And under the Great Lakes Water Authority,
You would have a 6-member board. 2 would be appointed by the Detroit mayor, 1 by the governor, 1 each by Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties. And this would make it much easier to privatize the system. In fact, during negotiations with the suburbs, Orr put out bids to privatize DWSD. He got 30 different offers, one from Veolia, also United Water, and this is published in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere. But essentially, this is a bargaining tactic. They didn't actually go through with the full privatization, but what they did was, in the GLWA memorandum signed by L. Brooks Patterson and other suburban leaders, they listed Veolia as a contractor that would be hired to assess cost containment strategies, which probably is going to mean laying off unionized municipal workers. Veolia was also hired by the emergency manager of Flint, and Veolia claimed that Flint's water was safe at the same time in 2015 in their report. So, while this is going on, of course, you see a skyrocketing of shutoffs. In March of 2014, DWSD institutes a new policy where they'll order a shutoff if a household is behind by either 60 days or $150 in arrears. And so they shorten the amount of time and shrink the amount of money that's required for a shutoff. As a result of that, you see a skyrocketing of shutoffs coinciding with the privatization offers. And it rapidly increases. I'm not even going to try to go through the whole history of resistance here, and many of you know more about it than I do and haven't been directly involved, but I'll just very briefly say. So, of course, we know that in June, under pressure from the People's Water Board and Michigan Welfare Rights and others, the UN High Commissioner of Human Rights denounces the shutoffs. There are mass protests, particularly in June and July of 2014. Thousands of people marching in downtown Detroit. 29 people were arrested performing civil disobedience led by the Homage 9. And despite mass protests, despite civil disobedience, the shutoffs continue. Now, Alice Jennings and a number of other local social justice attorneys filed a lawsuit against the city for a moratorium on shutoffs on behalf of 10 residents, including Nicole Cannon and others, who were at health risk because of lacking access to water. By this time, over 150,000 Detroiters, over a third of them children, have lost access to water for an extended period of time. And Alice Jennings told me in an interview that she believed that Judge Rhodes was actually sympathetic to at least a temporary moratorium, but it was Mike Duggan who was especially adamant about no moratorium on the shutoffs. And the reason was because he wanted the bonding to go through. Well, what is the bonding? The bonding is refinancing with the same banks that are being paid the swap termination fees. So that means refinancing with Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and the rest of them. These are the same banks that got bailed out, the same banks that sold the adjustable rate subprime mortgages, and the same banks that sold the interest rate swap that are now making literally over 40% of revenues at DWSD, 40 cents on every dollar that poor people pay for water, is going to pay the debt service to those banks. And that was why the shutoff moratorium was not allowed, essentially for the bondholders. Of course, in October of 2014, we know that Leilani Farha and Katerina de Albuquerque, the UN Human Rights Rapporteurs, come to Detroit. They meet with people who are at risk. They talk to, you know, families where a daughter was forced to use bottled water during menstruation, the kind of humiliation that that creates. They denounced the city of Detroit for violating international human rights laws to which the U.S. is bound, including the right to water, but also the right to non-discrimination, because it overwhelmingly is targeting African Americans. Clearly systemic racism. The shutoffs have continued, however. They continue not only through the period of emergency management, but even after Kevin Orr left. And that only goes up to 2015, but they continue to the present. There's been a falsification of history around this issue. In July 2014, the Detroit News published an editorial at the height of the protest. And the Detroit News said, "The narrative being pushed by community activists is that water is a right and no one should be shut off for non-payment. But even in the days of community wells and aqueducts, citizens came together and taxed themselves to pay for obtaining and delivering water." So they're creating this narrative that says that back in the day, everybody paid for water. But now people are lazy and they don't want to pay for it. Well, that's utter garbage. It's nonsense. Even in the 1860s, during the Civil War, the director of the poor in the city offered certificates to those who could not pay to obtain water. And of course, we know Hazen Pingree, whose statue sits downtown next to, not far from a fountain. He himself said in 1897, "If it is right for the city for the sake of better civilization to furnish free schools, free libraries, free parks, it is right for the city to furnish free water for the promotion of cleanliness, comfort, and self-respect in the homes of its citizens." That is, the idea that we can't afford water is nonsense. And activists aren't even calling for free water. They're not going as far as Hazen Pingree did. And that's supposed to be radical.
In 1933, Hal F. Smith of the Detroit Water Department, during the depths of the Great Depression, when the city's almost bankrupt, says water would not be discontinued where the only result would be to deprive a family of water service. That was too inhumane in the depths of the Great Depression. And yet now we're supposed to believe that it's fine. I just want to say one more thing. We're told that we can't afford it, right? That we can't afford to have more water assistance, that a family that owes $150 should be shut off because there's not enough resources. And yet at the same time, we see Dan Gilbert is worth $4.5 billion, getting over $100 million in tax breaks for his latest skyscraper project. Mike Ilitch, who's worth over $5 billion, gets $284 million to build a hockey stadium with 99 years rent-free so that an artist like Kid Rock, who's a Trump supporter, can do a concert downtown. Philip Morris, the world's largest cigarette company, owned the Detroit Incinerator, which is a known contributor to asthma, cancer, and lead poisoning, for 17 years, from 1991 to 2008, and it got $200 million in tax breaks because of a special loophole in Ronald Reagan's second tax cut in 1986. Marathon Oil got $175 million to expand its oil refinery, contributing to more toxicity and pollution in Southwest Detroit from the Detroit City Council. And so we have industries that are literally killing people with toxic pollution, and they're being given hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks. We have real estate developers who are some of the richest people in the world who are being given hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks. And yet we're told that we don't have enough money, even as the Trump administration is talking about cutting their taxes even further right now. Supposedly we don't have enough money to keep water on for children, for sick people. It's a lie, and I hope no one believes it. So just to wrap up, I want to conclude with the statement Martin Luther King made 50 years ago. Speaking to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Atlanta in his speech, Where Do We Go From Here, King said, "Why are there 40 million poor people in America?" When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. Who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that is two-thirds water? King was questioning water bills. So, in conclusion, obviously we need an immediate moratorium on the water shutoffs. And we need a real water affordability plan, not this pathetic joke of a water assistance program. But more generally, as King said, we need to question the relationship between systemic racism and capitalism and white supremacy. We need to claim public control over the commons to reverse the theft of water, air, land, and democracy itself. Thank you.
That was Dr. Josiah Rector speaking at Detroit's Museum of African American History. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, has posted a new essay on prison radio. He calls it Sex Wars.
Social movements first change consciousness, then they change society. heard hints and whispers about the casting couch. It was simply the way things were. How many women accepted such vile treatment on their road to fame and fortune, only to find that everything that glitters ain't gold? Today, because of the courage of such women, we are seeing the extraordinary costs of such a couch. But this time, the men in power are paying the price.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.